Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, June 16, 2023. A Justice Department civil rights investigation launched after the killing of George Floyd concludes the Minneapolis Police Department engaged in a pattern of violating the constitutional rights of and discriminating against Black and Native Americans. Just ahead, Attorney General Merrick Garland speaks about the report, and we talk about it with USA Today Justice Department reporter Bart Jansen. President Joe Biden travels to West Hartford, Connecticut to mark the anniversary of his signing a bipartisan gun safety law, but also calls on Congress to do more, including banning assault weapons to prevent mass shootings. President says he plans to nominate Dr. Mandy Cohen, the former North Carolina Health Secretary, to be the director of the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says one of his goals during his trip to China this weekend is to establish better lines of communication between the U.S. and China. And we'll get analysis of Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia's forces in eastern Ukraine from former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, retired General Philip Breedlove, and former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor. And Daniel Ellsberg, who was the leaker of the Pentagon Papers that showed the U.S. expansion of actions in Vietnam without the public knowing about it, has died. He was 92 years old. Reporting from ABC News, the Minneapolis Police Department for years engaged in a pattern of discriminatory law enforcement practices against Black and Native American people using unnecessary excessive force and violating the rights of protesters expressing their First Amendment rights. A more than two-year investigation by the Justice Department released Friday found the results of the sweeping pattern or practice investigation, prompted in part because of the police killing of George Floyd that sparked racial justice protests across the country in 2020, showed that the systemic problems of MPD made what happened to George Floyd possible, the department said in its final report. That reporting from ABC News. Attorney General Merrick Garland traveled to Minneapolis, Minnesota for a news conference with the police chief, the mayor, and other officials on the release of this report.
As I told George Floyd's family this morning, his death has had an irrevocable impact on the Minneapolis community, on our country, and on the world. His loss is still felt deeply by those who loved and knew him, and by many who did not. George Floyd should be alive today. Shortly after I was sworn in as Attorney General, I announced that the Justice Department had opened a separate civil investigation into whether the Minneapolis Police Department, the MPD, and the City of Minneapolis engage in a pattern or practice of unconstitutional or unlawful policing. I am here today to announce the findings of that investigation. I am also announcing that the Justice Department, the City of Minneapolis, and the MPD have agreed in principle to negotiate towards a consent decree. Since opening the investigation, the Justice Department has engaged in a comprehensive review of MPD's policies, training, supervision, and use of force investigations. Our review focused on MPD as a whole, not on the actions of any individual officer. We observed many MPD officers who did their difficult work with professionalism, courage, and respect. But the patterns and practices we observed made what happened to George Floyd possible. As one city leader told us, quote, "These systemic issues didn't just occur on May 25th, 2020. There were instances like that that were being reported by the community long before that." The Department of Justice has concluded that there is reasonable cause to believe that the Minneapolis Police Department and the City of Minneapolis engaged in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the First and Fourth Amendments of the United States Constitution. There is also reasonable cause to believe that they engage in conduct that violates Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Safe Streets Act, and the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Attorney General Merrick Garland at a news conference in Minneapolis. With more on the Justice Department's report on the Minneapolis Police Department, we're joined on the phone by Bart Jansen, Justice Department correspondent for USA Today. Thank you for being with us. A two-year investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. What is in this report?
Well, basically, they found four major points: that the Minneapolis Police Department routinely uses excessive force for no reason, unlawfully discriminates against Black and Native American people in the enforcement activities, violates the rights of people engaged in protected speech, so like people at protests and reporters at covering protests, and then discriminates against people with behavioral disabilities. So four pretty hard-hitting findings from this report.
And what happens next?
The Justice Department and the city officials are going to negotiate a consent decree so that there will be an independent monitor enforceable by a federal court reviewing the changes that Minneapolis makes to its police department, basically making sure that not only do they, you know, curb the unnecessary use of force, curb the discrimination, the racism in their policing, but that they do it to the standards that federal authorities looking over their shoulder are going to hold them to.
What has been the response from the police department in Minneapolis and the local elected leaders? Do they agree with the Justice Department's findings?
Yeah, the city officials attending the news conference today were supportive of the report and saying, pledging that they want to move forward and make corrections. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said that the success of the city is going to be defined by people feeling safer when interacting with police in our city. We're not going to stop until every single person in every single neighborhood and zip code feels safe interacting with police. He said that the city has already taken some steps. They've prohibited neck restraints as seen in George Floyd's murder, and no-knock warrants, one of which in 2022 led to the death of a person whose house police broke into. They've also replaced the police chief and the city attorney since George Floyd's death. So the new police chief, Brian O'Hara, said that he's worked under a consent decree in Newark. He knows how to do it. He knows how to improve policing, but says it's not an easy job. He says, "We acknowledge the pain, anger, frustration, fear, and sense of vulnerability that people have, and he's going to try to fix it."
We're talking with Bart Jansen, Justice Department correspondent with USA Today. The death of George Floyd kicked off protests nationwide and also a conversation about police reform. And Congress has been considering bills, but not able to reach an agreement between Republicans and Democrats to pass something. How does the Justice Department investigations of police departments fit in with that reform effort? Do they complement each other, or is it a side-by-side? How does that work?
I would call it side-by-side. The Justice Department officials are saying basically that you cannot do the type of policing that Minneapolis has been doing, which is shooting people without assessing whether deadly force is necessary. I mean, in one case, a woman calls 911 to report an apparent sexual assault in an alley. When the police arrives, she comes up to the police car and the officer shoots her dead because she spooked him. They want to stop the unnecessary use of violent, deadly force in policing. They want to stop the discrimination. They found these statistics that Blacks and Native Americans are pulled over more often, searched more often, arrested more often than their representation in the population. So the Justice Department is saying none of these things should be allowed, you know, under any police department. You've got to police responsibly, police lawfully under the Constitution, protect people's rights. So they're going to try to work that out. I've covered a bit of the debate over policing overhaul in Congress. And basically, lawmakers have talked about whether you could possibly make it easier for people to sue police departments when they allege misconduct or wrongdoing. And that has just been a hill too steep to climb so far. There's a section of law called Section 242 that basically prevents suing an individual officer or a police department for the official conduct of their duties. And that just blocks a lot of civil litigation that would be sort of a hammer the community could hold over a police department. The times that you get an actual criminal charge, such as the convictions against the four officers involved in George Floyd's death, is very rare. And so looking to Congress, you'd be waiting to see if there might be changes in Section 242. But up to this point, that has been just a non-starter in both chambers.
And a final question, sort of related to that, putting the investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department in context, how often does the Federal Department of Justice investigate a local police department and find these types of violations?
I don't know off the top of my head how often they get to this point where they're going to have a federal consent decree, but they are not. But it does happen occasionally. One of the things that Associate Attorney General Vanita Gupta mentioned was that consent decrees have worked in other cities such as Seattle, Albuquerque, and Baltimore, that, you know, they negotiate what needs to be fixed, and then they oversee the cities while they work their way through making the changes. Now, officials are expecting it to take several months just to negotiate the consent decree, and then that it could take several years to implement all the changes that they're recommending. But as she says, the findings laid out in the report are troubling. The community is hurting, but that the Justice Department is committed to working with Minneapolis to fix the problems.
Bart Jansen, Justice Department correspondent for USA Today. You can find his articles at usatoday.com and on Twitter, it's @GanJansen. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And President Biden putting out a statement this afternoon. I was briefed by my team on the Department of Justice's independent findings of unconstitutional practices of the Minneapolis Police Department. The findings are disturbing and underscore the urgent need for Congress to pass common sense reforms that increase public trust, combat racial discrimination, and thereby strengthen public safety. President Biden also talking about combating gun violence today. A CNN article says that he is marking 1 year since the passage of the first major gun safety legislation in a generation during a summit in Connecticut. As gun violence reaches record levels in the United States and additional congressional action remains stalled. Last year, President Biden signed legislation called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act into law, a significant breakthrough on one of the most contentious policy issues. The administration has also implemented 24 executive actions to try to reduce gun violence. But in the absence of congressional action, the White House has turned their focus to state action to try to reduce gun violence. That reporting from CNN. Here's President Biden calling for further federal action to address gun violence at the University of Hartford in West Hartford, Connecticut.
For those who say they're concerned about crime, you can't deal with crime without dealing with gun violence. It's a simple proposition. Remember, for a long time in America, car accidents were the leading killer of children. This was mentioned earlier. Then in 2020, guns became the number one killer of children in America. Guns. More than car accidents, more than cancer. Let me say that again. We can't let that just become another statistic. Guns, the number one killer of children in the United States of America? Folks, it's time once again that we banned AR-15 rifle-style weapons. High-capacity magazines. They're not only a weapon of war, they're the single biggest driver of profits for the gun industry. That's why they're selling them. Profit, 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 the single biggest. As I said, we did it once before in 94, and 10 years after that, the ban was, mass shootings went down significantly, the number of mass shootings. That's when the ban expired, mass shootings tripled. But let the ban on assault weapons, high-capacity magazines come back into vogue. Look, I find it outrageous that of all the industries in America, and by the way, I've been doing this a long time. I know I don't look that old, I know. I'm a little under 103. But all kidding aside, I'm going to say something outrageous. I was a pretty powerful senator. I pretty managed some of the biggest committees, judiciary, foreign policy, et cetera. But I didn't know 10 years ago. I didn't know that their gun manufacturer is immune from liability. I didn't know that. Gun manufacturers. Just imagine how many more people would be dead if the tobacco industry, was immune from liability. You couldn't sue the tobacco industry. I'm being deadly earnest. Think about the number of people who would be dead today that are alive because we could sue them. And they paid billions of dollars for the damage they were doing. Well, ladies, we need to end immunity for gun manufacturers. We got to hold them accountable. And it's time we establish universal background checks that require safe storage for firearms.
President Biden at the University of Hartford in West Hartford, Connecticut, at a National Safer Communities Summit. It was hosted by Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, and gun safety and violence prevention groups, including Everytown, Moms Demand Action, and Giffords. Today, the man who killed 11 worshipers in a mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018 was found guilty of federal hate crimes charges. A jury will now decide if Robert Bowers will receive the death penalty. President Biden is running for re-election, and on Saturday he'll be holding his first official campaign rally with union members in Philadelphia. C-SPAN Radio and Television will be carrying it live starting at 2:15 p.m. Eastern. President Biden today announcing his intent to appoint Dr. Mandy Cohen to be director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention when the current director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, leaves at the end of this month. President Biden writing, as Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Cohen developed innovative and nationally recognized programs that improve the health and lives of families across the state. Her leadership through the COVID-19 crisis drew bipartisan praise, as did her successful transformation of North Carolina's Medicaid program and pivotal role in the bipartisan passage of Medicaid expansion. That from President Biden. Dr. Cohen also held senior roles at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services at the federal level. And she is currently executive vice president of a private organization, Allied. And she was in that position 1 year ago when she was interviewed at Duke University Business School and asked about her leadership style.
I'm a very values-driven leader, but I would also say that my leadership style changes depending on the circumstance. But at the core of it, I think values are really important to both articulate and then live every day. So my team, particularly at the state level, knows we had 6 values. I talked about them all the time. And in almost every all-staff communication in any meeting, I would bring those values into the work we're doing, being people-centered, proactive communication, transparency, stewardship, joy, and belonging. So those are the values that we as a team decided that were really important as stewards of really important work in health and human services. And we used that as our guidepost so that when there was tension and a hard decision, I'd bring that into the room and say, are we living up to our value of transparency here? How are we thinking about stewardship in its tension with being people-centered? As we make a hard decision to say, should we fund this or that? So values for sure, but I would also say leadership style has to change with certain circumstances. And I would say as I led through COVID, I was much more of a directive leader than I would have said my first 3 years at the state, where I would have said I was a much more collaborative consensus building leader. Not that I didn't listen to my team during COVID, but we were in such a crisis, we had to move so fast that there were certain times where I said, you know, we need this by tomorrow, please go. we didn't have time for like the deep analysis, consensus building. So I do think certain different circumstances require different things from leaders, and adaptability is certainly high on the list.
Good.
Dr. Mandy Cohen interviewed at Duke University's Business School 1 year ago. That from their website. Today, President Biden made official what had been reported for a couple of weeks, that Dr. Cohen will be nominated to be the new CDC director. The News and Observer newspaper in North Carolina had an article this week that read North Carolina Senator Ted Budd, Congressman Dan Bishop, and other Republicans are citing Dr. Mandy Cohen's track record during the COVID-19 pandemic in opposing her as the next director of the CDC. In a letter to President Biden, 28 House and Senate members wrote that Dr. Cohen is unfit for the position and that throughout her career she has politicized science, disregarded civil liberties, and spread misinformation about the efficacy and necessity of COVID vaccinations and the necessity of masks during her time as the Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, and that she also had a history of engaging in partisan left-wing politics. That reporting from the News and Observer in North Carolina, Dr. Cohen's nomination will require Senate confirmation to be CDC director. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 108, NASDAQ down 93, S&P down 16. The UPS Teamsters Union has voted overwhelmingly to authorize a call for a strike if no deal is reached by the current contract's expiration date of August 1st, the union announced today. The International Brotherhood of Teamsters, union representing more than 340,000 UPS workers, said 97% of participants voted in favor of authorizing a strike. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Story from Associated Press. Shortly before setting out for Beijing, Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday emphasized the importance of the U.S. and China establishing better lines of communication. He will be the highest-ranking member of the Biden administration to visit China. Secretary Blinken's trip came within a day of happening in February, but was delayed by the diplomatic and political tumult brought on by the discovery of what the U.S. says was a Chinese spy balloon flying across the United States. That was from AP. Secretary Blinken spoke today at the State Department.
We look forward to having a series of meetings with senior officials in Beijing, building on the engagements that we've had with the PRC since President Biden and President Xi met in Bali late last year. And to summarize it, the trip has three objectives. First, to establish open and empowered communications so that our two countries responsibly manage our relationship, including by discussing challenges, by addressing misperceptions, and avoiding miscalculations. Second, to advance U.S. interests and values and those we share with allies and partners around the world, including speaking directly and candidly about our very real concerns on a range of issues. And third, to explore the potential for cooperation on transnational challenges, global economic stability, illicit synthetic drugs, climate, global health, where our country's interests intersect and the rest of the world expects us to cooperate. Intense competition requires sustained diplomacy to ensure that competition does not veer into confrontation or conflict. And again, that is what the world expects of both the United States and China.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a joint news conference in Washington with the visiting foreign minister of Singapore. A reporter asked the secretary whether he will discuss with the Chinese officials the cases of Americans held in Chinese prisons and determined by the U.S. State Department to be wrongfully detained. And also, what happens next with U.S.-China relations after his trip this weekend?
Yes, I will be raising the detainees. This has been an ongoing conversation with the PRC, and something that for me is always at the top of my list, that is looking out for the security and well-being of Americans around the world, including those who are being detained in one way or another, including arbitrarily. More broadly, what we're working to do on this trip is to really carry forward what President Biden and President Xi agreed to in Bali at the end of last year, which was to establish sustained regular lines of communication at senior levels across our governments, precisely so that we can make sure that we are communicating as clearly as possible to avoid as best possible misunderstandings and miscommunications. Because if we want to make sure, as we do, that the competition that we have with China doesn't veer into conflict, the place you start is with communicating. And so we'll see what comes from this visit, but This is directly in response to what the two presidents agreed in Bali last November. And as to what comes next, let's see how the visit goes. I think Vivian said it very well. This is an important, in a sense, insufficient step because there's a lot of work to be done. I'd note as well that even as we're trying to make sure through better communications that the competition doesn't veer into conflict, we're also looking at areas where we might cooperate in the interests of the American people, in the interests of China and its people, but also in the interests of people around the world. One of the clear demand signals that we get, including from our close friends and partners, is that both the United States and the PRC will responsibly manage this relationship and look for areas where our cooperation might produce results that benefit not only our own people, but people around the world, including in the region. So we'll be looking at that as well.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken today at the State Department. He leaves for China today with meetings with Chinese officials scheduled for Sunday and Monday. Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin, chairs the Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the U.S. and the Chinese Communist Party. And he wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal this week with the headline, Zombie Engagement with Beijing. The subhead is, the Biden administration seems determined to revive an approach to China that has failed for 30 years. Congressman Gallagher was interviewed today about this op-ed on CNBC.
Our next guest says the U.S. is trapped in a cycle of zombie engagement with Beijing, in which America tries to keep talking, and China keeps doing pretty much whatever it wants. Joining us right now is Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin. He chairs the Select Committee on China in the House. So what do you think the answer is, to disengage?
No, I think it is to, first of all, dramatically enhance our military deterrent, particularly across the Taiwan Strait, so that we prevent a conflict. And right now, I worry about the increasing risks of conflict, which you guys know better than anyone would be incredibly devastating economically. But then, and perhaps most difficult, is to get about this business of selectively decoupling. I say selectively decoupling in key areas so that at a minimum, we can start to reduce the leverage that the Chinese Communist Party has over us. What I'm worried about, as I allude to in this op-ed, like a zombie in a horror movie rising from the grave, is that we're going back to this idea that we can engage with China and induce them to act responsibly, but instead we see rising aggression across the board. And our fear of provoking Xi Jinping leads us to self-deter. It leads us to shelve key defensive measures that we need to take. And beyond the fact that engagement as a core pillar of our strategy has not worked for 30 years, the problem with the zombie engagement, in my opinion, is that the Chinese Communist Party exploits our ardent pursuit of meetings and photo ops as an opportunity to advance their totalitarian and often anti-American agenda. So when filtered through the ideology of a Marxist-Leninist regime, that olive branch we constantly extend becomes an invitation to aggression. So we need to be smart, we need to be strong, but we can't get lulled back into this idea that economic engagement will somehow induce the CCP to become a responsible stakeholder.
Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin, interviewed today on CNBC. An article from Reuters, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin expressed optimism on Friday that he would eventually hold talks with his Chinese counterpart after being snubbed by Beijing during an event in Singapore earlier this month. Secretary Austin spoke at a news conference at NATO headquarters in Brussels, where he was attending a NATO defense ministers meeting.
Let's go to Ellie, CBS News.
Thank you for doing this. As you know, Secretary Blinken is traveling to Beijing this weekend, and one of his stated goals is to improve military communications. How would you describe the current mill-to-mill communications with China, and have you reached out for a meeting with your counterpart since Singapore? Thank you.
Well, thanks, Ellie. As you know, I have made an effort prior to going to Singapore and while at Singapore to engage my counterpart, and I'm confident that over time that's going to happen. We're going to meet at some point in time, but we're not there yet. Not because we didn't try to, and we won't continue to try. As you know, I was in Singapore a week and a half ago. I've been on the road quite a bit, and so I've not reached out since. But again, the door is open, and my phone line is open, and so they can pick up the phone and call at any time, and we'll continue to work to make sure that we have open lines of communication. Ellie, you've heard me say a number of times, I think it's important that countries with significant military capacity and capabilities have the means to talk to each other so that we can manage potential crises and make sure that, things aren't allowed to unnecessarily spiral out of control. The kind of relationship that we want to have with China is one of competition and not one of contention. So we'll continue to work to make sure that where and when possible, we open those lines of communication.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at a news conference at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium. More from the Reuters article. Chinese officials have blamed the United States for a breakdown in dialogue by ramping up sanctions on Chinese officials, and they bristle at the U.S. military presence in the region, especially naval transits through the sensitive Taiwan Strait. Another Reuters article talking about the war in Ukraine. Advancing Ukrainian troops are facing desperate resistance from Russian forces around the eastern city of Bakhmut and are inflicting big losses on Russian troops in the south, Ukrainian military chiefs said on Friday. Russia has not officially acknowledged Ukrainian advances in the early stages of a counteroffensive and said it had inflicted heavy losses on Kyiv's forces in the previous 24 hours. Again, that from Reuters. In Washington, the Atlantic Council held a discussion about Ukraine's counteroffensive. Here is retired General Philip Breedlove, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, and William Taylor, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, asked what Ukraine needs to do to be successful.
The successes of Ukraine are being almost entirely controlled by what the West gives them to accomplish their objectives and their successes. So we have already set the stage for whatever they do based on what we have given them. And as we have already discussed in this meeting, we have given them enough to remain on the battlefield, but we have not given them enough to affect the complete removal of Russian forces from Ukraine. That's what the West still, I believe, needs to give Ukraine. Other good news is Ukraine hasn't sat down and briefed at least very many of us on what their goals are, because we leaked like a sieve and we don't want our conversations to give away their plans. But my guess, as I mentioned earlier, my expectation is the great generalship and leadership we've seen so far in this war against Russia. Ukraine has some set objectives. They will be bounded by the amount of kit and training that we have given them. And I expect that they're going to want to do two things, as Constantine and others have said. They need to have some sort of very visible victory to keep the momentum, to keep the morale, to signal to their people that this is headed in the right direction. And that I believe they will also have some very tactical application. My hope would be that they, as Constantine said, sever the land bridge, secure the water supply so that the water is cut off to Crimea, and then drop the Kerch Bridge in multiple locations to separate Crimea from Russia. Over.
Well, that's certainly a plan. Thank you. Bill, would you like to jump in on this as well?
The only thing I'd add is that if the Ukrainians find the weak spot in the Russian line, if they then focus their existing kit, their existing new brigades, newly trained, newly equipped, high morale brigades, and concentrate on that they could break through and do the kinds of things that General Breedlove just described, take the kinds of territory that Constantine just mentioned, that will demonstrate the validity of our support so far. We still need to provide more, and I would go back to the ATACMS and provide the rest of the kit, but that would be a good demonstration of success. And then the real effort is to demonstrate to the Russians they can't win. And they have to come to the table once it's clear that they can't win.
William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and retired General Philip Breedlove, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, part of a panel on the Ukraine counteroffensive hosted today by the Atlantic Council and covered by C-SPAN. You can find the full video at cspan.org. Russian President Vladimir Putin today said that Russia has sent the first nuclear weapons to Belarus as part of a previously announced deployment. And the Russian president said, quote, "This is a deterrence measure against all those who think about Russia and its strategic defeat." President Putin spoke at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. From the Washington Post, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the voluminous top-secret history of the Vietnam War known as the Pentagon Papers, a disclosure that led to a landmark Supreme Court ruling on press freedoms and enraged the Nixon administration, serving as the catalyst for a series of White House-directed burglaries and dirty tricks that snowballed into the Watergate scandal, died June 16th at his home in Kensington, California. He was 92 years old. Daniel Ellsberg was on C-SPAN's Washington Journal Morning program in 2009, talking about a new documentary about his decision to leak the Pentagon Papers.
So Judith Ehrlich, Rick Goldsmith co-produced this documentary. It's called The Most Dangerous Man in America. Remind our audience what that phrase means and who put it out there.
Well, most people don't know actually why Kissinger would have called me that. When I put out the documents, they were mainly of the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, which President Nixon then tried to stop by the first injunctions in our history. It really, he was doing that not because he didn't like that information out. That was a leak that he actually liked the content of it out. He was afraid, however, with good reason, that I had information on his own nuclear threats and his own threats of escalation, which he had yet to carry out. And that by revealing them, I would block him from doing that because the public might not think it was a good idea to start nuclear war over South Vietnam. So he had to shut me up. I was dangerous to him not because of the Pentagon Papers, in fact, but because I'd copied other documents that related directly to him. He didn't know what they were entirely. And in order to stop me, he hired people to blackmail me by getting information from my former psychiatrist's office and in another case to incapacitate me totally. And these were crimes that had to be covered up.
Daniel Ellsberg on C-SPAN in 2009. He has passed away at the age of 92. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Democrat from California, tweeting, "I'm sending my deepest condolences to the family and loved ones of Daniel Ellsberg, a dear friend and a fearless anti-war activist." And finally, Sunday is Father's Day, and so we go deep into the C-SPAN video library. A portion of the late Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia's Father's Day speech on the Senate floor in 1997, as he read the poem, "That Dad of Mine."
Well, he's slowing down, as some folks say, with the burden of years from day to day. His brow bears many a furrowed line. He's growing old. That dad of mine. His shoulders droop and his step is slow. His hair is white as snow. But his kind eyes sparkle with a friendly light. His smile is warm and his heart is right. He's old, oh yes, but only in years, for his spirit soars as the sunset nears. And blessed I've been and wealth I've had in knowing a man like my old dad. And proud I am to stand by him as he stood by me when the way was dim. I've found him worthy and just as fine, a prince of men, that dad of mine.
The late Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia, on the Senate floor in 1997. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word, the stories that Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend, and to all the dads, Happy Father's Day.